Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker. 100 degrees, boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. A kettle has to keep reheating the water. A cooker, though, keeps the water hot all the time, which means it's more energy efficient. How does it keep the water hot, Tim? I have no idea, listener. It's to do with vacuums. And I don't know what that means and how it works. But what I do know is if you can afford one, I recommend it. It is a great bit of kit. I truly love mine. And I've not met anybody yet who's installed one and gone, well, that's a bit rubbish. Everyone just loves them. Mine also does filtered water, still and sparkling. Sparkling water from a tap. Can you Adam and Eve it? I'm living in the future. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk. And there you can find out, or look at all the styles and find out more information about them. Today, I'm curious about how you can get the buzz from alcohol without drinking alcohol. Right, joining me to talk about this is a neuropsychopharmacologist, Professor David Nutt. David specializes in research of drugs that affect the brain. He is chairman of Drug Science, a nonprofit organization which he founded in 2010 to provide evidence-based information on drugs. I've heard a lot about David in the past. I've wanted to interview him. Professor Nutt in the past. I've wanted to interview him or have a conversation with him, let's say, for a long time, because he's one of the leading guys talking about drugs and what happens to you. And, you know, if you take things like psilocybin or ecstasy, he knows all about it. And obviously alcohol. So hopefully this will be a fantastic conversation. Let's meet him. Here's David. Hi, David. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining me. I've been wanting to speak to you for years, actually, because, you know, I became very aware of you, which I'll hopefully talk about later, when you became, when you were sort of advising policy in the government.
Sacked? Is that the word you're looking for, when I was sacked?
I didn't want to mention the sacking word. But yeah, when you were sat, and you came to my attention then, all those years ago, and it seemed to me that you know, you seemed to, we'll get onto that later. But first of all, I'm intrigued by everything you're doing at the moment, because you're doing a lot. Also, I've been on your psilocybin trial, which we will discuss later. But how would you describe what your job is at the moment? Because you seem to have lots of irons and lots of fires.
Okay, yes, so it is complicated. So I'm Professor of Neuropsychopharmacology at Imperial College London, which is where I am sitting now. You can see that vast bank of PhD students, theses above me, waiting to fall and collapse me and crush me to death. That's half time. And in there, I do my psychedelic research. And then the rest of my life, I spend doing work with my charity I set up called Drug Science, which I set up when I was sacked by the government, so we could have in this country, and actually it's globally leading now, a group of experts who tell the truth about drugs rather than just pander to government whims or sort of the press's desires. But also, I've been trying for many years, going back to 2004 really, to develop an alternative to alcohol, using the same kind of pharmacological principles that you might use to evaluate the harms of other drugs. If you do that for alcohol, it's pretty clear that alcohol is a pretty harmful drug. So it makes sense to try to find something a bit less harmful. And that's my commercial target, which is a company called GABA Labs and a product called Sentia, which is a botanical alternative to alcohol.
Okay, let's get onto that then straight away, because you're talking about it. So what is GABA to begin with? Because I've been reading up on this, and my brain hasn't, ironically, my brain hasn't quite grabbed what GABA is.
So GABA is a neurotransmitter. Now, I guess you and all your listeners will know about dopamine, the sort of drive, the Moorish transmitter. And you'll know about serotonin, which is the transmitter that kind of chills you out and lifts your mood, etc., and calms you down. But GABA is actually much more important. There are way more GABA receptors. GABA has a much broader effect in the brain than either dopamine or serotonin. And it's the core calming transmitter in the brain. It's the transmitter which regulates brain function from birth to death. And the brain really is driven by two neurotransmitters. There's a yin and yang. One is called glutamate, and that's the drive, will keep you awake, keep you more and more and more alert until you have a seizure. GABA is the counterbalance to that. So, and those two neurotransmitters are the absolute core workings of your brain.
So when you have a drink and you're doing consuming alcohol, what does it do to your GABA that makes you feel good then?
So we know that alcohol is what we call a very promiscuous drug. Alcohol will probably affect the majority of the neurotransmitters in your brain, and there are at least 80 of them. But the low entry level, when you start to drink, when GABA, alcohol first gets into the brain, it begins to tickle at the GABA receptor. And that is largely why people drink, because by turning on the GABA system a little bit, you become more relaxed, you become socially more engaged, you become more convivial, you begin to it breaks down that social anxiety, which of course we all have when we're in a party or something. If you're on an aeroplane, the first thing they do is to when the seatbelt signs come off, it's to serve you a drink. Why? Because you want to turn on your GABA system, because so many people are phobic about flying. So it's the calming, sociability, relaxing neurotransmitter that is the primary target for alcohol for most people. But if you keep on drinking, then some people get high and some people will get very disinhibited and some people will get so drunk they don't know what they're doing. That's other neurotransmitters. As alcohol levels go up, they start to affect the dopamine system, the endorphin system, the glutamate system. But the sort of entry-level effect of alcohol is through GABA, which is why we're targeting GABA to get that effect that most people want, the sociability, the relaxation.
Yeah. Talking about airplanes, I always think it's bizarre, isn't it? Because you go on an airplane, you're really excited probably because you're going somewhere and you've got all your, you're anticipating a fantastic time wherever you're going generally. And then you sit down and you think this is very good. And then they start telling you how the plane's going to crash. It's the only thing in the world where they do that. And I still have no idea. I suppose in case of emergency, but they don't do it on a train, do they? They don't do it on a bus. It's only aeroplanes you do it. And the chance of you surviving a plane crash is so remote anyway I don't know why they bother doing it, I suppose.
Well, yes, and it would be different if they were charging for the booze, because they might want to be winding you up so you'd buy more, but they're not generally. I think it obviously dates back to the days when planes did fall out the sky. And they.
Yeah, I suppose so. So is there a amount of alcohol that this is obviously quite a subjective thing I'm going to ask you, but is there an amount you should have which kind of tickles the GABA, gets it going, gets you into that state before crossing the line? I know it'd be different in every single person, but is there in every human that thing where you suddenly cross the line and suddenly alcohol becomes very Moorish and stuff like that?
Well, actually, it's a super question. It's an absolute super question. The answer is no. There are people that you know and I know. I'm married to one where alcohol is never Moorish. After a couple of glasses, she doesn't want any more. She's had enough. And a lot of people like that. In fact, it's probably only about 15 to 20% of people who actually lose control when they start drinking. They're the bingers. And that's where we think the dopamine system or the endorphin system gets turned on, and then they completely lose control. They're seeking the cocaine-like rush from dopamine rather than the chilled-out mellow effect of alcohol.
So this drink that you've invented called Sentia, how does that work? Because there's no alcohol in it, is there?
No, there's absolutely no alcohol. But what's in it are herbs which have been established through centuries, maybe thousands of years, in different cultures, in Chinese medicine, in Ayurvedic medicine, in classical sort of Western herbalism, herbs which we know have been used to produce calming, relaxation for social occasions. So what we've done is looked for those, explored those herbs, found the ones which work on GABA, put them together in a cocktail, a concoction, and that's the drink. And the drink is essentially herbs which contain ingredients which work to tickle up the GABA system in a similar way to one or two units of alcohol.
Right. Okay. I haven't tried it, David, but I've read some reviews on it, and reviews on, because I was quite shocked, because there's a lot of this stuff comes around a lot. Yeah. And I was shocked because I was reading on publications that I respect going, this stuff works. And it's so bizarre that why aren't we doing more of it? Is it that brand new, the science behind this? Or are you saying has it been around for a long time in other cultures? It's just moving its way over to the West now.
No, I mean, centaur is an invention because we have put together four herbs which directly target the GABA system. And the other herbs, there are about 11 herbs altogether in the drink, they also facilitate the effect. So they facilitate the uptake of the herbal active substances from the gut and facilitate their entering into the brain. So it's a sophisticated sort of pharmacological cocktail delivery system that delivers the key herbs that target GABA. So it is very unique. No one's ever done anything like this before, to my knowledge.
So what does it taste like?
Well, the clever thing is that we've actually worked with a lady called Vanessa, who's an absolute genius at making things taste beautiful. If I just gave you the first four, where we started doing this, we were working on, you know, down in my house in my study making, and the base herbs don't taste particularly good, but she has managed to find a collection of other herbs to add in, which give it a flavor. And this particular flavor for centaur is a flavor, it's like a strong vermouth. It has a quite a deep purple color, red color. That's why it's called centaur red. It is like a vermouth, and some people like it neat, but most people want to mix it, and it mixes pretty much with anything. You know, I usually use tonic or Coke, but it goes well with orange juice. It goes with any mixture you like. So it's actually becoming quite interesting to mixologists who are looking for non-alcoholic cocktails that actually people want to drink more than one of.
It's everything generally, it seems, with drugs. If you take too many of them, I'm not saying this one's a drug, but if you take too much of it, then it becomes a problem. Would that be the same with this, or is it just like drinking too much mint?
Well, I don't know. I've never drunk too much mint. I imagine if you put a hell of a lot of mint, you might have quite an interesting experience. I've never thought about that. Thank you. But you mean mint tea, do you?
Yeah, but I don't know. I was just thinking, is it completely harmless? Because if it's doing something to GABA, should you not be taking too much of it?
Well, okay. No, that is an absolutely critical question. And we've mitigated the risks of overdose, is what you're kind of saying. You know, can't you poison yourself on anything? Well, you're more likely to poison yourself on water, we think, than centaur.
Right.
Because your body clears centaur faster than it clears water. We've pitched the dosing or the combination to produce an effect which is about one to two units of alcohol, depending on the person. Small people want 2 units, bigger people maybe one. But it plateaus out. So if you drink our bottle, you wouldn't, all that would happen, that effect would last longer. It wouldn't get higher.
Right.
And the clearance rate, we've adjusted it to, so that you get an effect the same as alcohol within 5-10 minutes or so. Obviously, you get the flavor, which is an effect in itself, the taste. But then it wears off after about 30 to 45 minutes. So even if you took a whole bottle, you could probably clear it within a couple of hours, much faster than alcohol.
Are we on the cusp of a lot more substances being discovered? We'll go into your history with drugs in a minute, but clearly there's been a war on drugs for the last 50 years. You know, LSD was invented way back, and we in the West weren't allowed to take LSD, you know, unless it was illegal. It was an illegal substance to take. And I assume most people in the professions of medicine and science weren't messing about with it because they didn't want to spend time in prison. So I wonder if people were steering clear of a lot of investigating of chemicals and substances to the brain because you probably knew they would just be made illegal immediately. Ecstasy's illegal, psilocybin's illegal, blah 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 blah. That, you know, natural. I assume psilocybin's more natural than LSD. They both sort of do a similar sort of job, but people had to steer clear of them all. Would I be right in saying that?
Oh well, yeah, it's kind of worse. It's really worse than what you said, because actually they were legal. Psychedelics were legal until 1967 in America, until 1971 internationally. And they were banned, not because they were harmful. In fact, well, we've got massive data. 40,000 patients were treated with LSD. 1,000 papers were published on the beneficial effects of LSD and psilocybin. Very little evidence of any harms. These drugs were banned simply because the young Americans who didn't want to fight in Vietnam, so-called draft dodgers, were going to California. They were taking LSD, listening to writings of Timothy Leary, listening to concerts with the Grateful Dead, and they were opposing the war, as were a lot of other people. So LSD got associated with the anti-war movement. The American government couldn't ban being anti-war. I mean, they probably thought about it, but they couldn't. Maybe in Britain today you could. If you were protesting a war, you could be locked up. And in those days, you couldn't ban the protests. So they banned the drug. And the drug, that ban has persisted for 50 years because the hysteria that was told about, you know, the stories which created the harms, people burning their eyes, looking at the sun or jumping out of trees, you know, they was almost all fictitious, but they're kind of compelling. The medical profession bought into it in a big time, which is actually one of the more reprehensible historical sort of failings of medicine. And it got encoded internationally because America at that time controlled the United Nations. It got encoded as an illegal drug or illegal drugs, most tightly controlled drugs in the whole world. Only one country in the world didn't sign up to the UN conventions, I think, on psychedelics, and that was North Korea, where I don't think there was much use anyway. So what you have is a perfect storm. You had the fear of working with it, the fact that as soon as it became illegal, the US government stopped funding the research, and they'd funded almost all the research up to that point. Even if you could get funding from charities or philanthropists, getting hold of the drug was almost impossible because they didn't want people to work on these. The idea was to eliminate all knowledge because people genuinely believed it was changing society. And it's the worst censorship of research in the history of the world. There is no question. You know, we've taught 55 years when the therapeutic potential of these drugs has been denied millions of people worldwide. I find it, you know, you can hear in my voice, I find it really very distressing that so many lies were told to deny access. Let me give you another example. So they put psilocybin is put into Schedule 1 of the UK Misuse of Drugs Act, alongside things like carfentanil or fentanyls. Now, I have to have a special safe. It's just there, by the way,
okay.
to store my psilocybin. Why can't I put it alongside the heroin or the other forms of legal fentanyls in the pharmacy here at Hammersmith Hospital? Oh, no, they say. It's a Schedule 1 drug. And I say, but it's much less harmful than Schedule 2 drugs like heroin. Oh, yeah, but Schedule 1 drugs need to be kept in a special. We've created a bureaucratic monster, which is very few people have managed to overcome. So that's why there's still so little research, because it's still internationally, these drugs are still considered as dangerous as crack cocaine and as crystal meth, which is completely fallacious.
I think this is a good time to talk about the trial that I went on. So I heard through basically a doctor friend of mine who said, there's a psilocybin trial going on in the Imperial College. Why don't you sign up? So I just contacted, said, can I volunteer for this? And they went, yeah, all right, come in. Eventually, after I went through various...
Well, you know, I was going to say, I hope we tested you.
went through
how many heads have you got?
Yeah, exactly right. Went through a few hoops, went and did the bit where you have to, you know, have a chat about it. And let me say, by the way, before I talk about this, don't go and buy psilocybin or magic mushrooms off someone in a pub and do it. It's all about set and setting, making sure you're in the right place. These substances are dangerous. So, you know, just don't go and do it unless you're doing it in the right manner, in the right place. But I eventually did it, and I was absolutely terrified about doing this. I've never taken drugs, recreational drugs. Drunk so much alcohol in my life, ridiculous amounts, which is so mental, isn't it, really, that alcohol's legal and all these other ones aren't. And I was terrified about it, but I thought, well, look, there's nothing I can do about this. So, you know, I've signed up for it. And then the doctor came in and said, oh, what are you doing in the trial today? And he went, don't worry about that. You'll be fine. And I was like, oh, okay. So I feel good now.
We got much worse stuff.
That's basically what he did. It was great. He was like, well, no one dies of psilocybin. But he goes, I'm next door if ever you want to. And the way it was set up was fantastic. As you know, I had a couple of people who were going to guide me through it, who I trusted and were great. And I took two doses, which they didn't tell me. I had my brain MRI'd all the way through it, which was fantastic, and I had to do tests. There was a month apart between the first test and the other one, and I had to keep on doing tests during the day to see how I was feeling. And then lots of questions asked me. And I'll tell you about my experience. Was probably in the top five experiences of my life. Even I might even go into the top three. It was absolutely incredible because the guides you had were fantastic on it. And I went into what people would call a bad trip, trauma. And it was 5 hours worth of physical trauma where I cried and my body gyrated and everything. And it was one of the most beautiful experiences I ever had. It was like I was resetting my whole brain. It was like someone had pressed the reset button on me. Let me see through all the trauma. Let me see through all my life. Have to do that. And the tears were what felt wonderful that I was getting that all out. And I had this unbelievably overwhelming sense of empathy at the end of it, which was, you know, it took me a couple of weeks to actually get back into society, to feel that I could enter society again, because I looked around and went, society's bloody crazy. Look at it, the greed and the desire. Yeah. So it was such a strange thing. But I tell you, I you know, if you asked me to pay you £1 million to do it again, I would, because it was the experience was phenomenal. So and I have spoken to the people since, but obviously I think the data, you have to keep it quite secret, don't you? Well, not secret, but you're not allowed to just go around telling everybody. But doesn't it just...
I can tell you now. We are, the study's finished, so I can tell you now. And I think you probably worked out that you had a low dose and a high dose. You probably noticed the difference between the two doses.
Yeah. Very much so. Right.
And we have shown, and just exactly what you said, that people find it remarkable. They actually understand that the capacity of their brain and the way that a lot of what they've been thinking over the years, the way they've been, their approach to life has been constrained by things beyond their control, like trauma. And that psychedelics allow you to reframe that and break free from many of the misconceptions and put you in a much better place, a place where you are much more in tune with yourself and with other people. And the really clever thing, and that's why this study was so important, we have shown that after the big dose, I think you were tested a month after each dose, there you can see that the brain is more flexible. You know, that experience of being, having more empathy and of being kind of more aware of the stupidity of the world, the rest of the world, is because your brain is actually has been like a reset. It's like a defrag. Yeah. We can show that in terms of physiological changes. So that's why it's very thrilling to be doing this research, because it's not just that you, Tim, have signed up to be a kind of follower of Timothy Leary. No, your brain has actually been changed in a way that I can say, look, it has been changed. This is real. This isn't just you fantasizing things. So,
I can say, and when I tell people about it out there, they've tried mushrooms in a field or something, and they can't quite. The experience, by the way, I was put in a room. They were listening to, there was a playlist, and I had things on my eyes, so that I was sort of going in rather than out. And when they took the mask off me, I came out, and it was just brilliant and funny and lovely. The room was moving, and I had to, because I felt very safe. I had a wonderful experience. But as soon as the mask went back on, I went inside, and that was it was such an amazing little adventure inside me. It felt like I was going for an adventure inside me, which was fantastic. But when I mentioned it to some of my friends, they're like,
you were going on an adventure inside you. You were going to think places that your brain had repressed. It had stopped you, blocked you from accessing them over, you know, the last 10, 20 years. You know, your brain is a very clever thing, but it can control your mind in ways which you may not want it to control, and you don't know you're being controlled.
Yeah.
And the psychedelics break down that. They allow your mind to get back to where it wants to be.
Yeah. I suppose that's the thing with the alcohol and the GABA thing, Sentia, as you say. It's just loosening the brain enough to actually lose control a bit, to enjoy yourself. I assume that's
right. Well, that's right. Obviously through completely different mechanisms. I mean, Sentia is GABA and psilocybin is through the serotonin system. Different receptors in different parts of the brain, different parts of the cortex. But they both have beneficial effects, because they, in the case of psilocybin, they allow you to completely rethink many of the assumptions you've made in your life. And that's why people often say, wow, it's one of the five most interesting experiences of my life, even though, you know, I was taking it in a scientific study.
Yeah.
How weird.
Yeah.
With Sentia, it's different. What we're doing there is we're taking off this low-level anxiety, which is... You know, it's like humans are always anxious. We're not, you know, almost every, if you're not anxious, yeah, you're probably going to get into trouble. You're not worried about missing the train or the bus. You're not worried about performing at work. Anxiety is almost the sort of defining state of humanity. And that's why alcohol is such a pleasant drug, because it, for almost all of us, alcohol takes away that anxiety and allows us to do what humans really want to do, which is to socialize. Mm. And but the problem with alcohol is that it has this inherent toxicity. And with Centia, we can get around that. But the other thing I perhaps haven't explained enough is that we are also trying to make a single molecule alternative to alcohol. That would be an ingredient. We call it Alcarel. So that would be a little molecule that could actually go in as an ingredient into anyone's drink instead of alcohol. Ah. So companies could make alcohol-based drinks or Alcarel-based drinks. Now, we've invented that molecule, and we're in the process of trying to raise funding to take it through the safety testing to make it a foodstuff. That'll take a few years and take quite a few million pounds. But at that point, then we could potentially roll out this alternative to any drinks company that wants to make a drink that doesn't have alcohol in it.
That'll change society as we know it, probably.
And also, Tim, it would, and but it'll change it in the direction we know people want it to change. It's not... I mean, 5 years ago, I thought I was fighting the drinks industry, but now the drinks industry realizes that a lot of young people don't want to get drunk, and they certainly don't want the health harms of alcohol. The health hackers are scared of alcohol, particularly if they've got to go to work the next day. So there's a lot, there's a movement already of young people, particularly professional, you know, high-achieving young people, who are moving away from drinking in the week or even drinking at all.
Yeah.
But they'd like something that gave them the benefits of alcohol without the harms, and that's where... You know, so we're actually, since we've started this research, the trend has actually also been started accidentally in parallel by health conscious young people. We're riding
yeah.
on
that. Well, yeah. So interestingly, when I went on the psilocybin trial, about I was going to tell you then was there's so many people going, well, I wouldn't do that. I mean, Tim, are you mad that like the health risks you've put yourself through? And I'm like, but you do alcohol a lot, right? You're drinking wine daily at the moment, some of my friends, or, you know, you're getting hammered at weekends. And I'm like, you have been under general anesthetic, haven't you? Yes, I have. But you're fine with those, but you're not fine with this one. They're like, Tim, you don't understand what you're doing to yourself. And it's the fear we have, and including myself, by the way, which is why I told you when I got to the hospital, I was terrified. Yeah. The fear we've been given over the 50 years worth, yet, alcohol, even though it's got myriad types of cancer you can get from it, as you say, it's a toxin, it's poisonous. It's a bad thing to probably do on a you know, very regular basis, and et cetera, et cetera. Yet we're fine with that one. We're fine with taking any pills the doctors give us. We're fine with, you know, general anesthetics. And yet this stuff we're terrified of. They've really done a good job of making us terrified of the substance, haven't they?
Yeah, they have, and they've done it by never conceding the truth for 55, so that the people that knew the truth are dead now, and we're relearning. We have to relearn the truth, and it's been a horrific episode of disinformation. And that's well, it's great to hear you talk so sensibly about it. I'm pretty sure every single person on that trial, who you know, and it wasn't a trial for people that had mental illness. We weren't curing you of anything. All we were doing was letting you experience something which you find, and most people found, extremely interesting and often very beneficial in an unplanned way. You know, at the very least, you can see the capacity that your brain has to go see things differently. I mean, and that may well make you more creative, and it certainly, almost certainly, make you more sympathetic to other people's ways of thinking and to the way, you know, you plot your life from now on.
I don't want to bore all the listeners here with it, but it made me look at the world in a completely different way. But it made me feel like I was going back to me. That's what I really thought. Whereas I thought society had changed me so much into these thought processes that I don't want. And now I got back to what I want to do. You know, one of the big things I always talk about is Christmas. Whenever Christmas comes around, I find it really bizarre that the the desire and the greed and all this sort of stuff which happens constantly. And I look at it and go, I just don't like it. But every time I say that I don't like it, I'm greeted with bah humbug and Scrooge, because that's mm-hmm. the sort of catchphrase that they do. And so I'm in the wrong, because I'm apparently not happy that I'm watching just us all spend ridiculous yeah. amount of money that none of us have or don't got and stuff like that. And I see the world like that. And the sort of psilocybin made me go, no, you're right. You're right about that. And then I start looking at the world and I started looking at nations and started thinking, I mean, I'm getting really deep here, but it does feel like that. You start looking and you start empathizing with people in the world. And I mean, I think if everybody had a dose of psilocybin, I think the world would be a happier place. I really genuinely do, because I think the empathy overload happened to me. It must happen to everybody.
Well, I hope you're right. I can't say, obviously, I can't prove you're right. But what you have said is exactly, that is what the establishment feared, and that is why they banned the drug.
Right.
Because they didn't want people thinking, hang on, why are we voting to put so much more money into bombs and that are going to bomb the shit out of Laos and Cambodia? Why don't we just make peace? And yeah, that was, peace wasn't the way that the American economy or British economy or Western economies or most economies make their money.
Yeah.
So what you have described is a sort of microcosm of the threat of thinking differently that actually terrified the establishment, and that's why these drugs were banned.
How hard was it to get the test done over here? I understand it took you 3 years before we were allowed to yeah. take the to actually take the substance.
Yeah, it took us, in order to get our trial, the depression trial started, we had a 3-year grant, and it took 32 months of the 3-year grant to find somewhere to make it, because to put it into patients, you need a different kind of chemistry. You need a little to give it to, for experimental sort of physiological purposes, measuring the brain waves, you can actually use a different product. But to give it to patients, you have to have it made as a medical product. And you had to go through ethics committee. The ethics committee, we went 3 times. I took the NIHR, the Health Service's lead researcher for depression with me, Steve Pilling. And they said, well, you know, you can't be giving psilocybin to depressed people. Why not? Well, they might kill themselves. I said, well, never happened in the past. Why would they suddenly do that now? You know, millions of people have taken mushrooms. Even with Steve there, they said, no, can't do it. Can't do a random one. You've got to do a safety study. You've got to give it to them, you know, for 3 months and see if none of them dies, in which case you can come back and do another study. So it took a year to get ethics because they were of their fears. And then it took us nearly another year to actually get the stuff imported, because no one in Britain would make it because it's illegal. So we had to find a country where they could make it. And then you have all the problems with licenses getting it out of that country to this country. So 30 months to get it in the country, 2 months to get the final permissions. And then we started. And then, of course, the grant funders, the MRC, were saying, well, you know, why have you taken so long? And I explained, you know, it's taken so long because of all these regulations. And they were almost going to close the study down, but I persuaded them that would be unethical now we've gone so far. And it's got a bit easier now. Now it takes about 18 months to set up a study rather than 2.5 years.
Yeah, so as I understand it, the belief is that psilocybin's good for people's, especially people with mental health problems and stuff like that, but it can be good for you. LSD's not... But doctors would like to use LSD as well. I understand doctors would like to use ecstasy and ketamine too. Am I right with those four substances
You are totally right. Totally right. That's right. LSD is hard. We've worked with LSD, but as a therapeutic, it's a bit more difficult to work with because the trips are very long. And so it's a kind of prosaic economic argument. But if we want to do an LSD study, people have to stay in hospital overnight till the trip's worn off. And that then triples the cost of the hospital beds and that. So it becomes uneconomic to do LSD studies.
Yeah, mine was about 5 hours long, my big one, when you gave me my dose.
And you were able to go home afterwards, yes?
Yeah, I was able to go home afterwards, yeah.
With LSD, you'd have to stay in. So LSD is just, the trips are too long. It might be more powerful, I don't know. I'm not convinced about that. I don't think people get necessarily better or deeper insights on LSD. They get more time to have them, but I'm not sure. Anyway, LSD is harder to use as a therapy. Ketamine is quite good because ketamine is a medicine, so that's prescribable off license by doctors. And actually, that's something that I'm quite involved in at present because I cannot use psilocybin except in research. and I can't get any more research grants to study depression, I've now started working with a company called Awaken Life Sciences that have got a couple of ketamine clinics, because ketamine we can give, and they're the trips, usually 1 to 2 hours long, so we can that's quite convenient in a sense for people coming in the morning and going out in the afternoon. We've also done an MDMA study. That was that's not a psychedelic. It's an entactogen, an empathogen. But that we use that to help people with alcoholism who were drinking to deal with stress. And we found that a couple of those trips during the course of a three-month abstinence-based program was quite effective. It helped. More than doubled the success rates of staying abstinent, just those two MDMA sessions. People were able to overcome or reframe their mind about the trauma that was driving them to drink.
Yeah, okay. Apologies for that. There's so many noises going on in this podcast today. I've got someone at the door. Email is going off, but it doesn't matter because, I mean, the stuff we've got, we're talking about is fascinating. And I'm really getting frustrated listening to you talk about this stuff now because, you know, I want us to be able to use it. I want to see the idea that you can't get any more trials through. It just frustrates the hell out of me that we've arrived in this position. I mean, there are people out there that I know who've suffered very badly with depression. I think, you know, if you've got the psilocybin dose, it might help you. By the way, again, I reiterate, don't just go down the pub and buy some and go and do it. It's not going to work like that. You have to set and setting, as they always say.
Well, that's right. It's important. You mentioned yourself how we had guides present through your sessions. And that's critical because it's the person, the patient does the work in the trip. But making sense of the work can be facilitated by the therapist afterwards, as you found out.
Yeah, and just to let you know, right at the beginning of the big dose, I was feeling so sick, so nauseous, and they were there helping me and calming me and making sure everything's right. And I just felt so comfortable in it because I'd spent a lot of time with them before doing it, and I spent a lot of time, and it was great. I was in a hospital, everything was safe, everything was great, and that's the way. But I feel so sad that people can't have that experience because along the line, and you can't blame any politician for this I have been fooled until I started doing this podcast and found out about it, that the war on drugs is a very, very good thing. It's an amazing thing for society. Now I've done so much research on here and spoken to Neil Webb and all those guys. And, you know, I understand how destructive the whole war on drugs has been. And the war on drugs is so stupid why alcohol's illegal as well. It doesn't make any sense that alcohol's legal, but and tobacco and all the others that are illegal, cannabis, the whole shebang, it just doesn't make any sense at all to me anymore, and I feel the whole thing very frustrating. So do you mind us going back to where you were the drug czar for the government, and then you did some recommendations and then they sacked you? Is that what happened?
Yes, the sackings at the time I didn't quite understand it because, well, you know what I was just saying publicly, the results of research that the Home Office had done under my guidance. It wasn't as if I was saying something different. I was just saying, well, we've done some research. By the way, alcohol is more harmful than cannabis. Oh my God, you can't say that. Well, we've got to say that because I'm a scientist. Of course, you can't stop me telling the truth. Alcohol's not a drug. Of course, it's a drug. No, alcohol's not a drug under the Misuse of Drugs Act. Well, actually, it should be then. Oh my God, we've got to get rid of him. There were two things. There were two things. The truth came out afterwards. It's got an amusing little story. So the man that sacked me was the Home Secretary at the time, called Alan Johnson. And Alan, after he left politics, started writing. And he wrote a couple of autobiographies. In his early life as a child, had a very tough life, having to bring up his brother because his father left, etc. You know, it's quite a sad story of his upbringing. And then he wrote a second book about how he was, you know, getting into Parliament. He was a postman and then a union member for the post union, etc. Anyway, so after he was reading his second book at a book festival, and a friend of my wife's was there. And after he read a bit of his book, she stood up and she said, "Mr. Johnson, why did you sack Professor Nutt?" And he apparently got quite bristly about that. And he said, "Well, we've given him one yellow card for saying that ecstasy was less harmful than horse riding. Jackie Smith. And then We gave him another yellow card for saying that cannabis was less harmful than alcohol. And two yellow cards means a red card, which means he was sent off.
He's a referee, football referee. Excellent.
Well, I thought at the time that was kind of rather dumb thinking, dumb politics. You know, could people seriously think like that? The last year, I've realised that was quite sophisticated analysis.
Yeah, exactly right. I think the problem with politicians, and I've never met Alan Johnson, but I think the problem with politics is it's a power game. So it's not based on what's good for society; it's based on what's good for keeping their party in power. That's the first thing which is wrong. The second thing is the war on drugs has been so powerful because I was one of the people who believed it was the best thing to do and hated anything to do with the sort of drugs or anything else. I would never take them because I'm far too healthy. I'd get pissed every weekend, you know? I'm part of that way of thinking, which everybody else is. So it's very hard for a politician to do a complete about turn like I have. It's easy for me to do it. And even when I talk on about this on podcast, people, I remember an old agent of mine saying, "Be careful! What are you doing? Be careful!" I'm like, "I'm talking the truth." You know, it's like, but it must be quite hard for politicians to actually align with your way of thinking, isn't it?
Well, the Lib Dems have managed it, and the Lib Dems, they missed a terrible trick when they were in coalition. They could have, if they made one of their four ambitions, reforming the drug laws, they might have been reformed. But they trusted the Tories to be rational. In fact, it's remarkable we're having this conversation because in a few hours' time, we are launching the charity Drug Science's new book, looking back over 50 years of the Misuse of Drugs Act. Right. And the person who's doing the speech to launch it is the Lib Dem drugs minister from the 1910 to 15 cabinet, and that is Norman Baker. And Norman Baker was a drugs minister who... he resigned because the Home Secretary, a woman you might vaguely remember called Theresa May, refused her drugs minister to publish a report which said that other countries were doing better than us in terms of drug policy. I mean, as he said when he resigned, he said, the Home Office is like a branch of the Tory party. They have no interest whatsoever in getting to the basis or the evidence or the theoretical or even the practical ways of dealing with the drug problem. They just want the polemic. So that book is coming out. In fact, if you send me your address, I will send you a copy. I'll get it signed by him and me tonight, all right?
Perfect. I would absolutely love that. So are you frustrated by this? Is there any appetite, do you think, for government? I remember Boris Johnson the other day. I can't remember exactly what he was saying, but he was saying, don't worry, we're still going to be strong on the war on drugs. And I think that's what people want to hear, sadly. That's the problem. Do you think there's any appetite? Are we slowly moving towards a society where we can question it, at least question it whether we go with new policy? Are we got an appetite where we go in that way, that direction?
Well, young people completely are. And actually one of the reasons a lot of young people are drinking less is because they're moving to drugs like cannabis, where, you know, it's clear now that cannabis is less harmful than alcohol. So they're also moving to other drugs as well. So I think there's an enormous age division in terms of attitude to drugs. Young people who've tried drugs know the truth. Old people who haven't just believe what the lies and mistruths they've been fed. But I think the argument, it has been political. I think we have to reframe the argument and make it economic. We are wasting so much money pursuing a failed policy. Why not do what most American states have done now, which is, in the case of cannabis, legalize cannabis and then tax it. And that not only brings in a significant amount of revenue. Colorado got it through the first ballot because they said, you know, the first $4 billion were going to education. Tax cannabis, and that would bring in, but also that would also just reduce the consumption of alcohol, which is a much more deleterious drug. I mean, alcohol costs about $30 billion a year in terms of costs, direct and indirect costs, and brings in about 20 million. So it's about $10 billion a year net deficit. If we could reduce that net deficit by giving people a safer alternative, then that makes economic sense. And that's what I think we should get rid of. The moral argument of drugs is what's been pursued for the last 55 years. Particularly today, when economics is such a central part of decision-making, let's face up to the reality. Is it wasting money on drug policies that fail or make it worse? It's not just disingenuous. It's actually dishonest. Spending taxpayers' money doing something you know is worthless.
Yeah, I know. There's more violence. I mean, Ross Kemp did a documentary not so long ago about whether we should start arming the police more. And it's basically because of the war on drugs and the fact that because the drug guys have to protect, they can't go to the police, can they, when someone's trying to steal their wares. So they have to get, you know, more and more guns, more and more violence. And it's getting worse on the streets for the police. It's getting worse on the streets for the public. And yet we're still going down that policy. It's just insanity. I mean, we're going to end up like South America if we're not careful with the way they, you know, the violence down there.
Look, let's face South America's improving. Colombia now has a president who's actually said, I think last week, managed to pass some act of parliament condemning the war on drugs. So South America's over. When South America's overtaking you, you know you're really good.
Well, interestingly, Sue Perkins, the TV presenter, comedian, she was on my TV show not so long ago, and she'd been down in South America, and she went there. The idea of the show was great. It's stuff which was illegal over here, but is illegal in South America. So one of the things she did was she put on a bulletproof vest and got shot, which I thought was kind of like quite terrifying. And she did sort of, I don't know, loads of sort of strange things down there. It's actually quite a nice watch of a show. But I said to her on my show, what's different between South America and Britain then? What did you notice? She said life's cheaper there. And life has become cheaper because of the drug situation, because of the violence, because of the guns. That people, it's like if you go back hundreds of years here, you'd have 6 kids, 3 might die. You know, now all children pretty much survive. Yeah. So life is becoming more expensive, really. Life is cheaper, and we don't want it to go back there, do we? And we're moving that direction. So just to save the money on the amount of money we're spending on police and everything else, it just doesn't make any sense. Not to even just discuss it. It's crazy.
Well, this is the paradox. So, you know, we have in Britain now, we have a fascinating division between the Tory police and crime commissioners who want cannabis class A so they can lock up more people, and the more liberal or progressive police commissioners say it's complete and utter waste of time locking up people for cannabis possession, because all you're doing is driving them into the black market, into using harder drugs. But we had a Home Secretary, the first time she was Home Secretary, Swala Braverman, saying, yeah, let's make cannabis a class A drug again. Why? To stop people using it. You think, Guys, it was a class A drug back until 2004, some forms of cannabis. There's no evidence that it's ever, the drug laws have ever deterred any cannabis use. All you've done is created an underclass of people who've got criminal records for cannabis possession, mostly black and Asian minorities in London, who actually, you know, got so peed off 10 years ago that they had the London riots. I mean, you know, we've seen policies fail, and yet politicians just, well, whether they're ignorant or whether they just choose to ignore, I don't know. But it's either way, it's reprehensible, because, you know, you'd imagine that the person who was running the country's drug control systems, the Home Secretary, would at least be educated about drugs. You know, that's actually one of her main briefs.
Yeah. You know what? And also on this podcast, I was told that the people running the drugs, I mean, this is what they should tell the Tory party, the Conservative voters, is basically the drug industry over here is not run by your Cockney Sparrow. It's run by the Albanians over here. Pretty much, apart from apparently in the northwest of the area, it's pretty much a country run by Albanians. It's now got like these foreign gangs coming in, running our streets for us in our own country, and the violence level is phenomenal. I mean, even that should make us go, hold on a second, it's not a good old British trade anymore of drug dealing. It is a terrible, importing gangsters now as well.
Yeah, quite. Well, history tells that you go back 100 years and you see what happened in 1923. America voted alcohol prohibition.
Prohibition, yes.
You tell me anyone who thought that alcohol prohibition was a good thing.
Yeah.
I swear, Jay, why was it a bad thing? Well, because it led to organized crime. So why is drug prohibition a bad thing then? Or good thing? Why had, you know, they can hold in their mind that alcohol prohibition was a bad thing, and they can't just make that tiny little leap to all other drug prohibition is actually creating the same kind of underground criminal market, which is also a bad thing.
Yeah, well, we've been brainwashed. Hopefully podcasts like this will help. And prohibition, by the way, the alcohol prohibition in America only lasted 13 years, I believe. So it's it was a very short period of time. Are people...
Tim, I just want to say something about that. You're quite right. Alcohol prohibition only lasted 13 years. But the legacy persists today, and for this reason, that because alcohol prohibition created so much crime, every policeman in America was corrupted by the people running speakeasies, the illegal bars. So they had to create a separate branch of government called the Drug Enforcement Agency, as we call it today, a separate army to fight the alcohol, the underground alcohol army. That persists today. The reason we have a war on drugs is because America has an army of DEA inspectors who are employed to fight a war. So the legacy actually didn't disappear. It actually turned. Went from alcohol to cannabis, and then they've moved from cannabis to heroin and to crack at that. But America's the only country in the world that has its own special police force to deal with drugs, and they cost a lot of money, and they don't want the law to change because that's their employment.
That's really interesting. And Neil Woods, who is on this podcast, and anyone who doesn't know, listen back to I've done a couple with him. Listen back to it because it is very good. And he's he was a plainclothes copper in the drug squad. And he says that you don't tell anyone in the police your business because you don't know who's a legit copper or who's a dodgy copper.
Corrupt, yes. And it's not just the police. I mean, one of the big problems we've got now is corruption of... prison officers by synthetic cannabinoids, these very, very potent drugs which can be put into slips of paper and sold. Yeah, I mean, drugs corrupt broadly, and it's particularly problematic. You know, with Neil, I think one of his colleagues was probably going to tell on him, and he could have died as a result. So it was very disturbing for him, and I think he's still been traumatized subsequently. And yet,
yeah, he is.
What he did was amazing because he actually managed to get the head honchos who were running drugs in Northampton busted. And he thought that was the great success. And then he said 4 hours later, gangs from Leeds and Manchester had moved in to take over. They were shooting each other because they were fighting over the territory. And the situation was even worse. And at that point, I think he realized, you know, he'd put his life on the line for months to try to do something that was completely and utterly pointless.
Yeah. Listen, David, I'm conscious I'm taking up your time. Just as a final thing, going back to the science of it all, are we now in a situation, you've done your trial, are you talking to America? Because I know they'd been doing some trials over there, and I believe Holland and Germany might have been doing some as well. Are you all talking to each other about what you're finding? Is there a little network now of people who are going, come on, these things are good, these sort of drugs?
Yeah, there are quite a number of conferences of psychedelic researchers. What America has really jumped ahead of us now. I mean, my group here at Imperial, you know, we're still the world leaders in terms of the brain science, but we're one. There are two groups in Britain here and one at King's doing psychedelic research. In America, almost every university has got its own center for psychedelic research, and Oregon, 2 years ago in the last election, they voted to legalize magic mushrooms, and they're going to set up wellness centers with mushrooms over the state. So typically, you know, we've initiated the field, and the Americans have taken right over. But for me, I'm not so interested in psychedelic groups meeting and talking. You know, I go there and they pat me on the back and they say how wonderful. But I want to. My challenge now, and I was doing this last week in Orlando, is to talk to the people who don't believe. So I was talking at a conference of 2,500 Americans who provide addiction treatment services. And I was trying to convince them that there's good reason to use psychedelics to treat addiction. And most of them were saying, you can't use drugs to treat a drug addiction. And I'm saying, well, that is both stupid and wrong, and I can. And besides, what about other addictions like gambling, where people don't take drugs? But the level of resistance beyond the sort of psychedelic community is still pretty huge. So there's a vast amount of education to be done. And that's where I'm trying to do it. Because as a scientist and a practicing, you know, researcher, I can hopefully convince people that that I'm not just a, you know, a policy person. I do actually care about patients as well.
How did you get involved in it in the first place? I know you had how did this become your fascination and your passion?
Well, I'm a psychopharmacologist. That means I study the effects of drugs in the brain. The brain is a chemical machine. There are 80 different neurotransmitters. To study neurotransmitters, you have to use things like neurotransmitters, which are called drugs. And so all my life, I've been studying the brain using drugs to perturb the brain. And some of those have told me about how the brain works, and some of them have turned into really interesting treatments. Psilocybin is the best example. When I started this work, I'd given every other kind of drug, certainly every other kind of controlled drug, to human beings. I hadn't done psychedelic because it was just too difficult because of all the licenses. And I just thought, before I die, I ought to do that, because then I've got, you know, I've ticked all the boxes. And it was doing this brain scanning, like we did in you, that made us realize that the parts of the brain that psychedelics were working on were the parts of the brain which were wrong in depression. We could reset them. So this, right, all this clinical work came out of doing the basic science, and it, which is why it's actually very exciting and why we should do basic science, you know. Science itself can lead on to remarkable discoveries, which you wouldn't predict. I didn't predict.
David, it's been wonderful talking to you. What's next? What have you got next coming up?
Well, we are we're halfway through our trial in anorexia nervosa. We've just started our trial in fibromyalgia, and we're just starting a trial in OCD. So we've got plenty of work going on. And you might say, well, what are all these disorders got in common? They all, what they've got in common is they're disorders where people know they're thinking wrongly. Anorectics know they're not thin. You know, they're too thin. They know they're not overweight, but they think they're overweight. People with OCD think they're contaminated when they know they're not contaminated. And people with pain, well, they know that the pain is gone, their leg is healed, but they still got the pain in the leg. So these are syndromes where the brain has kind of taken over the mind, and we think psychedelics can break those habitual thought processes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure. And you can get Sentia just everywhere, or do you have to get off the website?
Yeah, you can get it off. Yeah, it's go on the web, just at sentia.com. It's also Planet Organic are now stocking it, so that's a good place to go and get it too.
Worth trying. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. It's a wonderful interview.